This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hi, I'm Siobhan, and coming up on the podcast of Afternoons with Helen Farmer, we spoke about Autism Awareness Month, financial literacy for teens, TikTok and UNICEF and how they're getting together against digital bullying, as well as Caesarean Awareness Month and raising leaders.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
It's an absolute pleasure to be joined by Nicholas Orland, who is Autism Programme Head and also Head of Dubai Autism Centre, to talk to us about the just recently campaign that they have launched, because April is the Autism Awareness Month. That's all coming up after this.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
A very good afternoon to you, Nicholas. Thank you so much for joining us on the line today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
So it is very special. April is Autism Awareness Month. Now, can you just tell me a little bit about some of the programs or the initiative itself? And I did mention earlier that it's under the motto, Accept Me the Way I Am. I am a child with autism. Why is it so important to celebrate and raise as much awareness as we can during this month?
Yeah. So, each year the stakes ultimately get higher because what we're finding is that the autism rate, it tends to get higher. So right now it's 1 in 54 individuals are on the autism spectrum. So therefore, the focus of these campaigns is to bring awareness to what autism is and what services are out there. Now, what we're focusing on this year, this is our 15th year of doing our campaign, and we're focusing on acceptance. And this is a really critical feature of our campaign this year because we want to focus on accepting that being different is okay. And we're focusing on this on all angles, from having workshops with children to adults, just to focus on the differences that we tend to see on the autism spectrum and how they're okay.
Yeah, gosh, is that 1 in 54 globally then?
Yes, yeah. Right. So that's what we're ultimately finding, yeah.
Gosh, that's and you find that that is on the rise? I mean, you said the Autism Centre has been, or Autism Awareness Month has been going on now for 15 years. How did those statistics compare with, say, when it first started?
So it ultimately, it's back in 1990, it was 1 in 10,000. So we've come from that to 1 in 54. So that rate continues to go down. And the thing that we're tending to see is that we're getting better at diagnosis. And also these initiatives, autism awareness initiatives, are now making it more socially acceptable to seek services. So one of the saddest things I tend to see is that there are families that are very resistant to get services or to even get screenings. And what tends to happen in those situations is that we'll have a kid who's 8, 9, 10 years old who needed services for the past 8 years, and the parent was very resistant to get those services because of the stigmas associated with autism. Mm. So now with these initiatives, our focus is on acceptance. By doing that, we can connect kids with services much earlier, and by doing that, we have much better outcomes.
Mm, absolutely. I totally agree. What sort of age would you then recommend, or can autism actually be detected? As you mentioned, there are those certain challenges, or great challenges, I think, with just actually getting a diagnosis.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of debate on this in the field, but usually around 2, 2.5 years old is when a diagnosis can be administered. However, you can see signs around 18 months. There are certain milestones, such as not making eye contact, responding to name, those types of things. So I just like to caution parents, just because your child's not making eye contact or not responding to their name doesn't necessarily mean they're on the autism spectrum. But what it does suggest is that there might be something more that might need to be remedied down the road.
Mm-hmm. And we talk about autism, and as we know, or maybe you can just explain a little bit further, a bit more detail of that, the spectrum of autism. And it is really quite, it's quite a large spectrum, isn't it?
Absolutely. It affects everyone differently. The old adage is, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. And what that means is it affects everyone differently. Mm. Everyone has different strengths and different areas of improvement. And really our focus, here at Dubai Autism Center, is to focus on teaching skills to children who don't yet have them. So if I've got, let's say I'm working with a four-year-old who's not yet able to communicate, not able to make friends, well, it's a big problem. I got to fix that. So our programming is focused on those particular areas to ultimately teach those skills.
And let's talk a little bit about the awareness campaign itself. There are various different aspects to it, aren't there? I mean, webinars across school, there's training, and lots of various different corporates are getting involved around Dubai and the UAE, aren't they?
It's really exciting. So we have our partner, DIWA. We're working with the RTA. Our ads are showing up on taxis, which is really great. Dubai Holdings, Wassel, Enoch, Vox Cinema. We created a video awareness campaign, and they've been showing our videos there. We have so many corporate sponsors, and we're so thankful for them because they're really making a big difference in these campaigns, because we can advertise through their efforts and their initiatives. So we're really focusing a lot on that. We're also providing workshops. So the workshops are going to be anywhere for children to learn more about autism. So we actually have 8-minute micro presentations where we'll present to children ages anywhere from 4 years old to 14 years old on what autism looks like and things that they can do within their school environment to be more accepting. We also present to individuals that might work at a hotel, for example. If a parent comes in with a child on the autism spectrum, what are some things that you can do to support? And it's really great that we're able to focus on that as well. And lastly, I'm really excited about this. We're offering free consultations for the month of April. One of the biggest challenges that I find is that there's a lot of barriers with starting services, from even getting diagnosed. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to get rid of as many barriers as possible. Mm. So we're offering free consultations. So anyone in the month of April can come into the Dubai Autism Center, and we will provide a free consultation and give our recommendations of if they feel that services or a more comprehensive assessment would be required.
That's absolutely fantastic. Thanks so much for sharing that information with us.
We are family.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon again. Yes, let me just reintroduce our guest. Joining us on the line is Nicholas Orland, who is Autism Program Head, and he's also the head of the Dubai Autism Centre, which was founded in 2001 and is the largest, most innovative and comprehensive non-profit organisation in the UAE, serving children with autism spectrum disorders. Nicholas, thanks so much for joining us on the line. We're discussing Autism Awareness Month, which it is in now. We are in April. So for the whole month, there are a whole number of activities and initiatives happening all over the UAE, webinars, and you've got free diagnosis over at the Autism Centre, is that correct? For people who would like to go down, bring their children with them. And it's an open space. It's a safe space for people just to come and have a chat.
Absolutely. And what's really great about our centre too is, you know, we have a hair salon, we have a movie theatre. It's just the most amazing environment I've ever worked in. It's really ideal to providing these services as well, which is really quite nice.
And how much of those services are geared towards inclusion into society, into mainstream schools?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Every single one of them. So our goal always is, you know, I ideally want to work myself out of a job where all of our kids are going to mainstream school environments. You know, we're really focused on that element of teaching skills and then fading ourselves out. And that's a really critical part of inclusion. And that's really what we do here. You know, we have an apartment simulation environment, our hair salon, like I mentioned. What our goal is, we want to teach these skills that our students are going to encounter in real life, so that they no longer need these services. So by ultimately creating those conditions where we can do that, we tend to have some pretty good outcomes.
Mm. We've had a couple of messages come through. Thank you very much, everyone. Fathea has asked, how is the parents' acceptance of the diagnosis? My friend has a great difficulty accepting it, even though she is a physician. What do you offer the parents? I think that's a really great question as well. I mean, what sort of services and support mechanisms do you offer for the parents of those children who have been diagnosed?
That is a wonderful question. And I think that that's a challenge in some other types of services we tend to see, in that we don't provide support to the parents, and we absolutely have to. For us, what we do is, through this process, we involve the parent. That's really the biggest thing that one can do in these types of services, is making sure that they're with us in everything we're doing. We're showing them everything we're doing, and we're providing them supports at home. Really, you know, when we look at this, these types of treatments, we are partnering with the parents. We're not doing this independently. We are equal partners, and our goal really is to create opportunities and you know, for our parents to really be as successful as possible. Mm. So our focus really here is just including the parent in everything we do, offering parent training for things that they can do at home. Because the other thing we got to realize is, you know, these kids that come to our center are usually here between 10 to 25 hours a week. But then there's all that extra time at home that we have to ultimately focus on training the parents on strategies for. So we focus a lot of time and opportunity on doing those things as well.
You also mentioned about schools. Now, it's fantastic. I mean, I know my kids go to mainstream school, and they have learned about autism. Their teachers are, you know, are very open about it. They have certain days where they understand what it's about. They're taught about it. And I am just wondering, though, that's great, but how realistic is it that schools are accepting of children who are on that spectrum? I understand that it is still very, very challenging to get kids who have been diagnosed into any form of mainstream school. Are you seeing a shift possibly in how schools are, you know, allowing, or their entrance values, or how, you know, how
I am? Yeah, it's definitely optimistic. What I really like is when I coordinate with a typical school, what I tend to see are that teachers, they want to accept children on the autism spectrum. It's not that they don't want to, it's that they don't know how. And what's really great about our field is that we've been seeing so many great innovations, so many great changes. And our goal right now at Dubai Autism Center is that we want to train people on how to do this. And through some of our workshops we're actually doing, we're providing training to teachers and LSAs and teaching assistants on how do you integrate somebody with autism into your classroom environment, because that is a big focus. But what's really wonderful about living in this part of the world is that we're getting it right. I'm seeing schools going in the right direction. They're focusing more on inclusion. They're focusing on how to accept students as opposed to putting up roadblocks for them not to come in. So I'm seeing a positive shift, particularly in this part of the world. And being from the United States, it's really wonderful to see that shift happening here. Yeah. But yeah, it's definitely going in the right direction.
And just finally for you, Nicholas, we've spoken about schools, but what about the workplace? You know, for those who have who are on the spectrum, who are reaching an age, you know, in their teenagers and older, then what happens? You know, they can't be sort of looked after in a school. Well, maybe some might have to, depending. Yeah. But how do you then integrate them into society? How do they then gain their own independence? Yeah. Maybe have their own apartment, you know, have their own job, be
absolutely
self-sufficient.
Yep. And this is a big challenge we're seeing right now with services globally, in that we do a great job of working from age birth to 18. But the second the child turns 19 or a young adult turns 19, suddenly all the services go away, and that's a big problem for us. So really what we do at our center is that as a child starts to get older, we start answering these questions. Okay, when the child, like, we accept kids up until the age, or young adults up to the age of 21. So when this young adult turns 22, what is their day going to look like? What are they going to be focusing on? And what we do is we program backwards. We go, okay, we have to find a job, a vocation, interests, things that they can do. And then we focus on teaching those skills to when they get up to that point. So it's going to be very important to do that.
Yeah. It's been really great to talk to you today. And thanks so much for just highlighting all the fantastic work that you are doing over there at the Autism Centre. And of course, the fact that it is Autism Awareness Month. And we really look out for all these fantastic initiatives that you are doing with various different corporations and schools. And again, just to highlight that if you would like to go down and have a free diagnosis, Autism Centre is open to head down there. That's right, Nicholas, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you once again, and all the very best with this very important month.
Thank you so much, and thank you to ARN.
Thanks. Nicholas Orland there, who's Autism Programme Head of Dubai Autism Centre.
You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Good afternoon. Up next, we're talking about TikTok and how they've teamed up with UNICEF for an anti-bullying campaign.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon. Well, with almost 700 million active users worldwide, TikTok, the video sharing social networking app, has been downloaded over 2 billion times. And I'm sure that's changed since I've looked up those figures. But has a net worth of over $50 billion. But as with any online app and network site, we have to ask, how safe is it for kids and teens with incidents of bullying, data mining and privacy concerns? Well, I'm joined now by Farah Toucan, Head of Government Relations and Public Policy at TikTok, Minat, to hear more about how TikTok and UNICEF have joined forces against digital bullying and promoting kindness on their site. Good afternoon, Farah. Thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure being part of this program today. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So tell us a little bit about this campaign, first of all.
Yeah, thank you. So basically, the Our Create, Don't Hesitate campaign is actually a partnership with UNICEF to fight cyberbullying and promote a safer and kinder environment on our platform. As you know, with the surge of people doing everything online lately, it has actually put millions of users around the region and globally at an increased risk of cyberbullying. So with our partnership with UNICEF and by introducing the Create Don't Hesitate, we are trying to reinforce our commitment to safety and highlight where we stand in terms of not tolerating any negativity, bullying or hate speech on TikTok. Mm. So far, this campaign has received almost over 23 million views actually on our application. So it shows how successful it is in terms of its spread and coverage so far.
Right. And how do you do that, though? I mean, what are some of the new features that you are adding to TikTok to really ensure the safety of those users?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. So basically, in terms of the features that we have many, many tools and features online that our users can actually use. As I said earlier, we ensure that we keep the platform safe and comfortable for people to be as creative and to express themselves openly on the application. Some of the app settings that are there are basically for you to choose as a user to make your account private, and it allows you to approve or deny followers and restrict your uploaded content to followers only. The second point is Wild Wits can be a fun way to explore your creativity as a user, but you can decide who can you make them with and who can make them with you. You can choose the setting for all of your videos or make that decision for each video individually. So basically, you're in control on who can react to your videos. Mm. There's also the ability of controlling, you know, whether to delete someone or permanently block a user from being able to view your contacts. Moreover, and the most recent features that we're super proud that we actually launched, there are two new features, the filter all comments and the rethink feature. They both complement our existing safety and privacy tools. The first one is actually giving our creators more control over the comments on their videos. And the second one actually prompts people to reconsider posting in-kind or inappropriate comments.
Right.
So basically, if you basically post a video and I come and then post something that might be negative or might be in the line of bullying or harassment, I will get a pop-up immediately saying, are you sure you want to, you know, post this? So it's like a nudge for people to remind themselves.
Yeah.
Exactly, to rethink the action. And these are the new two features that are designed to actually help foster kindness among our community and maintain that our users continue to have a positive and safe experience on the platform.
I suppose on the flip side of this, and in a way that, you know, potentially particularly social media is heading in terms of not being able to have an opinion or let's say, or those who have a different opinion or others, and this whole cancel culture How do you feel? Do you feel that in some way that there should be some kind of freedom of speech of such to say, well, I'm not saying by any stretch of the imagination that it should be cruel, unkind, or bullying. But if someone just says, actually, I don't like that, how is it sort of some kind of freedom of speech of sorts that if no one is criticised or allowed to give any kind of negative comments on anything anymore, is that healthy either?
Okay, so thank you very much. That's a very good question. I have to say, number one, we believe in a very inclusive community and an individualized expression. However, an expression without fear of being abused and bullied and harassed. We do not tolerate members of our community being shamed, bullied, or harassed. So basically, if you come and express yourself openly and candidly without actually harming someone else, that is not an issue. But when you come and harm someone else, that's where the distinction is. The reason why we are doing this is to ensure that, number one, is our commitment to ensure that we all have a platform that inspires creativity and brings joy to users. And as part of that, we want to make sure that we keep it as safe as possible for people and not to have any negativity out there. Obviously, it's not a challenge that it's a challenge that it's an industry-wide challenge. It's not only, relevant to TikTok. It's on all online sphere, let me say.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Farah. Sorry, we're short of time, but great that you have joined forces with this, and it's really great that it's been recognised and you've put a campaign in place to actually deal with it. It's called Create Don't Hesitate campaign. Is it up and running right now?
Yes, it's actually up and running, and you can check it out on the application.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks so much
for sharing that. Thank you. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Okay. Farah Toucan there, Head of Government Relations and Public Policy at TikTok, just sharing with us that campaign, @create, don't hesitate, promoting kindness on the TikTok site with new filters and comments and features, filter all comments and rethink. So take a look at it and let's really cut back on no bullying on TikToks and just promoting kindness and creativity instead.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Coming up, we will be chatting with Marilyn Pinto, and she'll be talking all about financial literacy for teens.
We are family. Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Well, we know how important it is to learn about money. We realise that our teenagers will undoubtedly be better off with this skill. We even understand that wealth is an outcome of financial literacy. So why is financial literacy still so elusive for our teenagers? Schools don't teach it, neither do high schools, colleges or even business schools for that matter. And teaching economics and business studies doesn't count. These subjects do not teach teens how to deal with their personal money. I'm going to be finding out next how and why it is so important to instill money mindfulness in your teens. Welcome, Marilyn, who is the founder of Kids Finance Initiative. Great to have you on the programme.
Hi, Siobhan. Thank you so much for having me.
So do you think financial literacy is a kind of a sort of an unconscious incompetence for teens? They don't know that they don't know about money.
Yes, it is very much an unconscious incompetence. They don't know that they don't know. They don't know how important it is. Most of our teens are too focused on getting good grades to get into college so they can get a good paying job, a well-paying job. But no one teaches them how to spend that paycheck intelligently. I mean, just imagine how much money all of us would have saved if we knew this when we were 15. I know I would have saved a whole lot of money. And that is what we're trying to say, that the teens don't understand how important this is, which is why initially when you try telling them that you're going to enroll them for a money management program, you're going to deal with some resistance. And we need to understand that and not give up that easily, because this really isn't something that they are conscious about. What we should as parents and as educators be conscious about is taking them from that journey from unconscious incompetence to unconscious competence. This is where they know and they have practiced so much and so well that they don't even realize they're using these skills.
And how critical is it to have some kind of financial literacy? I mean, from even a young age, you know, from when sort of age would you start talking about
it? Well, as soon as kids start saying "I want," would be a good time to start teaching them about money. But it is shown that, you know, kids as young as 5 and 6 can grasp the concept of money. Where it really gets interesting is I think the sweet spot for kids would be around the 9 to 12 years old. That's the first window of learning for kids, you know, the first 11 years of learning. And anything that you want to teach them, if you teach them in that window, you know, they're going to remember it for life. The earlier you teach them, the longer they have to practice, the more ingrained it is. They can internalize it as well. I mean, I've seen it myself. I've taught kids right from 7 up to, you know, 22 years old. And the older they are, it's just that much more difficult to teach them because their habits are formed, their mindset is formed. They have to do a lot of unlearning before they learn. Whereas when they come to us as kids, they're curious, they want to learn, their habits and mindset isn't yet formed. So you play a really important role in actually molding that, which makes a huge difference to starting early, I think.
Perhaps we could actually then, for our listeners today, just to have a few ideas from you how to teach that. I mean, I think it's very tricky to teach the value of money when we do live in a society, in a very new, modern, affluent society, and for the most part we are surrounded by just new modern and affluent things, people, malls, shopping, not even that, but what is online as well. It's a very different world now, isn't it? And I would imagine maybe you could share with us some tips or tricks that you have up your sleeve.
Well, I wouldn't call them tips because they are a little more, they require a little more thinking and strategy behind it. But yes, I understand what you're saying. It's tough, especially I think it's just getting tougher than definitely it was when we were growing up. So I think the first thing that parents should recognize is that they need to take responsibility. This isn't something that a school is going to manage for you or a high school is going to teach your kids, or they're going to pick it up along the way. I mean, they can, but they are going to pick it up by making painful expensive mistakes, which are going to cost them a lot of time and money. So I think the first thing for parents to do is recognize that this is in our capability to teach them. We need to, whether it's teaching them ourselves or signing them up for a class, it really is something that parents need to take responsibility for. And also realize that the steps and actions you take today can have a dramatic effect on your kids' financial success. And that's just a proven fact. So that is one thing. The second thing to do is that is to also realize that once you teach this to the kids, you can almost expect immediate results, because a good program is going to teach them something that's relevant to their life right now, that they can think about, that they can use in their life now, not in 5 or 10 years when they graduate, because that's not going to have much effect. Everything that you teach them in a good program is going to be completely relevant and relatable to them at their space where they are in right now. That is one thing. The other thing, I think, for parents, a lot of parents would like to teach their kids about investing, and most kids are very excited to learn about investing. But my advice here is to just wait, hang on. It's a counterintuitive mistake, because it seems like it's the best thing to do, because, you know, investing is the secret to wealth creation. That's how you get rich. But investing is like the roof of the house. We should wait until the kids have a strong foundation in basic money management. Do they understand what credit is, what the cost of credit? Do they understand the difference between a want and a need and how to prioritize? Do they understand the meaning of debt and that there are different kinds of debt? And all of these are really building blocks to teaching kids about investment. So I would say really just wait until your kids, and we at our program, we don't take anybody into an investing program who doesn't have don't have the basics. I think that's very, very important.
I shouldn't be telling my 7-year-old about blockchain investments just yet then?
No, definitely not.
Not that I could anyway. I'm sorry. Absolutely way above my head. But, you know, it's quite interesting, because I did try to find out, because my kids were asking me, can they have a bank account? I do remember many years ago, I had a lovely bank account with the Yorkshire Bank, which I don't think is actually around anymore. And once a week, I used to bring my little book in, and 20p or 50p or whatever it might be. And it added up. And, you know, over the years, it was something quite special, because that was my money and I'd worked for it. And I think it did have an impact on the way I relate to money. But I'm sure, please forgive me, correct me if I'm wrong, but I did try and find out about sort of bank accounts for kids, and it's quite difficult here. Maybe you've got some more insight in that.
It is difficult. I think banks are starting to, there are new offerings coming up, but as of now it is difficult. It needs to be a joint account with the parents.
Yeah.
But also, if I can just say something to that, just giving the kids a bank account or a debit card or a credit card or an allowance for that matter doesn't necessarily guarantee that your kid's going to learn about how money is or how money works. So you see, all of these are tactics. Mm-hmm. What I would recommend to parents is be a little more strategic about it. All of these are tactics, and I've had kids in my class who have, you know, who have credit cards with no limit on them. They have platinum cards, who, you know, they can buy anything they want there's no limit on the card, but they know absolutely nothing about how a credit card works, how money works, what a statement looks like. So it just goes to my point that just because we give kids these apps or budgeting apps or debit cards doesn't necessarily mean they know any more about money than kids who don't.
Yeah.
So what we need to do is just be a little more strategic about it. Start with the basics, make sure that we focus on the mindset, that they have the mindset first to think about themselves as savers, to think about themselves as responsible as spenders. And that makes a huge difference, definitely a lot more difference than having a debit card or a budgeting app is going to. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I do personally think that, you know, giving children what they want when they want and having unlimited amounts of access to money is actually pretty detrimental to to the rest of their life. And it has been proven over and over again. If you look at so many stories, particularly celebrities and that sort of, you know, that sort of lifestyle. But so are you a proponent of pocket money and chores? And again, I think that can also be quite challenging. Many people have got home help.
That's an interesting question, I think, especially in the kind of society that we live here in the UAE. So first, there's two parts to that. There is no actual evidence for either way. There's no actual evidence proving that having an allowance is going to help your kids, and because the results are all over. So, but it does. I think it would be a good thing to start giving your kids allowance. But if they first understand, again, allowance is a tactic. My first recommendation is be strategic. Make sure that they have gone through a program or they have learned the basics of financial. They know what is the need and a want, and they know how to budget. Then giving them an allowance makes sense, because then they can have a little more control. They have a lot more understanding. But coming to your second question about allowance and chores, I don't agree with that, just because doing chores is part of being part of a family unit. Mm. You know, do you get paid to cook to cook or to wash dishes or to make up the room? So
you shouldn't get paid for picking up your stuff.
Yeah,
off
you
the
should.
Floor.
So you should, exactly. That's part of being part of being a family unit. But and also, if you do that, then that's giving them undue leverage, because they might say, okay, I don't want the allowance, but I don't want to clean my room either. And then when you are sticking with allowance, and you know, there are a couple of rules that might help along. So, for example, use cash, because it's a lot more tangible and they're able to understand it more. You know, second is, it's just be consistent. So don't give them allowance 1 month and then next month forget, which tends to happen quite often with parents. So they start it for a couple of weeks and then it fades off. And then when they get reminded, they start again. The third thing is, don't link it to chores again. It's not a good...
What would you suggest? What would be some of the things that you would give it for then?
So for me, I can tell you with my kids, they get paid for stuff that they do outside of that. Extra is something that I don't. For example, if they wash the car, or if they, like my daughter loves to cook. If I want to go, if you're going out for dinner somewhere, and she bakes, I'll tell her to make a really nice dessert. She makes really lovely stuff, and I'll pay her for that.
Okay.
So it's for her that, and then she's made like a little rate card, and you know, so it also gives them a chance to be. It gives them a sense of agency that, you know, I can control this. I can if they want to buy something, they then think about things that they can do to help out at home, which is not part of their regular chores. They don't get paid for regular chores, but they do get paid for extra stuff that they do.
So if one message come through from Maud, and she said, hello, what is the class or program that you teach for teen finance?
So what we have is a 2 to 3 week program where we teach kids, teens, specifically everything that they need to know with regard to money management. So we start off with the basics. We then top this off with a week's classes on investing, where they learn, again, this is not about day trading or stock picking. It's about long-term investment building. How do they build their mindset? How do they understand all the terms that are being used? How not to fall for scams? So it's a pretty comprehensive program that goes right from the building blocks of needs and wants and things like that, right up to budgeting, spending wisely, impulse buying, and investing. The focus of our program is not just knowledge. We actually focus on implementation, because, you know, for knowledge, it's it's very easy. You can even get the stuff off the internet, you know, sort of for free. You don't have to pay, and you don't have to pay anything for it. But what's different, and specifically with teens, what they need is they need the feedback, they need the mentoring, they need somebody to answer their questions, which they feel is very specific to their situation. And all of this makes a huge difference. We've been doing this for the last 4.5 years now, and the focus on implementation and actionable takeaways that they get from every class is something that is something that's very different, and that makes a huge difference. And I would say makes all the difference in them actually implementing this. So you don't want your kids to just know this in terms of in just at a conceptual level. You want them to actually use it. And the feedback that we've got from parents or kids who've completed the program is actually how they have changed, what changes they have made in their life or in their lifestyle after doing something like
that. It's absolutely invaluable. I mean, totally. I really do understand it. Because you don't, as I mentioned in the introduction, you don't really learn it at school particularly. And a lot of the times, parents don't want to teach it either, or they might shy away from it, or
I think that's a little more complex than that. For one, I don't think any parents, because at our time financial education wasn't, I don't think it was a thing, so they aren't professionally trained, and then we're a little worried that, you know, we're not sure what to talk about, how much to talk about it, and also we have our own biases as well towards money, which may or may not be right, may or may not be helpful to our kids, mostly not. So the parents suffer from another issue. It's proximity bias, right? We're too close to our kids. They don't take us seriously. They don't, especially teenagers, they don't really listen to us at all. So if it's coming from your parents, you know that it's not cool. It's not, you know, you're not going to pay attention to it. They pay a lot more attention, however, if this is coming from an unbiased expert, which is why I really recommend that this is something that this is like, just like you wouldn't teach your own kids to drive, right? Sure. Because even though you might know to drive, you know that you may not be doing everything right. You definitely want them to learn the right way, to make sure that they know every aspect of even stuff that you are uncomfortable or don't know enough to teach them. You want to make sure that they do that, which is why I'd say this is one sort of really best left to the experts who understand, who are really good at what they're doing.
And
it's not saying come to me. I'm saying come to, you know, go make sure that whoever you go to, they really are. It's going to make a huge difference. Yeah.
You can start young, though, can't you? When they're younger, yes, it's obviously up to the parents. But when they're teens, then yes, let's bring in the outside experts to really drill down onto those issues and have tangible takeaways, as you said. Thank you so much to Marilyn Pinto there of Kids Finance Initiative. She's got loads of programs running for teens, loads of really interesting and invaluable advice as well on a blog. If you'd like to find out more, or in fact enrol your kids into one of her courses, which sound really, really interesting and definitely invaluable information that you learn from them.
Family Matters
on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon, I'm Siobhan Layden. I'm sitting in for Helen. And April is also recognised every year as Caesarean Awareness Month, where hospitals and medical professionals will be offering advice on this subject, which is not really discussed that much in public. Too posh to push was just one of the issues that some mothers faced if opting for a caesarean, and others as well. Well, I'm chatting now to Dr. Mariam Georgette Awatai, who's an OB-GYN at Gargash Hospital. Good afternoon, Dr. Mariam. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Good afternoon, Siobhan. Thank you for having me.
So it's Caesarean Awareness Month. What does this mean? And what are some of the issues that you're going to be highlighting over the month?
Today. Yes. Okay. So caesarean section, it's a very old operation. And really, technically, it's just about making an incision in a woman's tummy and getting to the uterus as safely as possible and delivering the baby. It has been around for quite a while. And the incidence of caesarean section, it's increasing. It increases year on. And there are many reasons for this. Women have a lot of choice and exercise their choices now to have caesarean births. There is an explosion of diabetes in the community, not just in men, but also in women. And so we are often looking after women with diabetes in pregnancy. Women have had previous caesarean sections, multiple caesarean sections in the past, and then have to have more caesarean sections when they're pregnant again. And women are, you know, they are accessing reproductive techniques like IVF and having multiple births, there's an increased risk or increased incidence for twins. Mm. Which then makes a cesarean section more likely. And there are multiple of other indications increasing the incidence for cesarean section.
Right. So, and all of those reasons that you've just listed could be the reason why you're seeing more people are opting, or not necessarily even opting, but having to have...
But have to have a cesarean section.
Right.
Mm. Absolutely. And yes, I noticed you mentioned in the opening too posh to push. And actually, in reality, it's a very small proportion of women who actually opt to... who say that they just do not want to push. Mm. Because if with careful antenatal care and with discussing exactly what labor and labor mechanisms are all about and how to protect the pelvic floor, a lot of women realize that actually a normal vaginal delivery, if it is an option, is going to be the best way to deliver your baby. And really, a woman coming to you and telling you, no, I do not want to do this, I do not want to have a cesarean section. I do not want to have a normal delivery, and I want to have a cesarean section as just pure choice. You need to delve down into why, whether it is a question of fear of labor, whether there are options and conceptions that she's been told that are not absolutely correct. But most women will have a cesarean section because there is a medical indication to have one.
Do you think, though, there has been talk, probably a little bit controversial to ask you, but I mean, the fact that medical insurance companies are pushing for cesareans, or even hospitals themselves are pushing for cesareans because doctors have very little time, it's convenient for them, they can book it in, they know when they should be there, they know how long it takes. There's this sense of convenience about having a cesarean, as well as financial gain.
Sure, absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned this because it is out there, this idea that doctors prefer to do cesarean sections. Actually, it is true that a cesarean section is a planned procedure in most, particularly if it's done electively. It is also true that the woman can also time her delivery, choose her dates in some cases, and that may be the aspect of the delivery that makes things better. But we always, as doctors, have a duty to patients. Cesarean section is a major operation. Mm. It is classified it's a laparotomy, so you are opening up an abdomen. You are going right into the abdominal cavity, and there are many pitfalls along the way. And I think that all good doctors will sit down and talk to patients with a lot of honesty and put out all the risks, potential risks associated with cesarean section, which would be that, you know, cesarean section is increased, there's going to be increased bleeding, there's compared to a vaginal delivery, there's a risk of infection, there is a risk of damaging structures that are around the uterus as you go in or as you come out, including the bladder, the bowel, large vessels. There is a big risk for clotting, thromboembolism. We know that thromboembolism still and remains the biggest killer of women worldwide, where a woman might throw a blood clot in their legs or in their lungs and, you know, really compromise her health.
Yeah.
And having a cesarean section and being immobile because of pain, post-operative pain, or the type of regional anesthesia that was used to perform the cesarean section, as well as being pregnant in the postnatal period, these all increase the risk for venous thromboembolism. And, you know, these are significant risks associated with cesarean section.
Right.
And therefore, I don't think that, you know, hospitals or even the insurance companies, actually, given the fact that if you were to take a normal vaginal delivery and a cesarean section and compare the risks associated with either of them, would willingly choose a cesarean section after thorough counselling. So I want women to feel confident that when they're asked to have a cesarean section, it really is because there is a clinical and a medical indication for it. And if in doubt, take a second opinion.
Exactly. Yeah, very good point there.
Join the conversation on Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Only on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm joined on the line by Dr. Mariam Georgette Awatai, who is an OB-GYN at Gargash Hospital. We're talking about Caesarean Awareness Month. And it is coming up, well, it's now, it is in April. We've got lots of more questions for Dr. Mariam.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon, Dr. Mariam. Thank you for staying on the line. So it is Caesarean Awareness Month, and I think it is quite interesting because we have lots of awareness months, which is absolutely wonderful to highlight various different causes and initiatives and issues that are. It's also Autism Awareness Month, and I think it's I've never heard of Caesarean Section Month Awareness Month before, and I think it is one of those subjects that still is there's a little bit of controversy around it. There's a little bit of, I don't want to say the word shame, but there has been, conversations about that. You know, I couldn't manage to deliver naturally, and women possibly feeling disappointed that they didn't get to have a natural birth. So I think it's great that there is a more conversations. I think it's great that we can have these conversations. And what do you feel about that? Do you think that women do need a bit more support in those options? Now, it's been quite some years since I had children, but I must admit, and I will say, there was no options available when I had my children, you know, water births or having it at home, or, you know, it was very, very clinical where you saw the doctor and there was no sort of meet the nice midwife and et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if that's changed since then. Perhaps you can clear the misunderstandings about that, Dr. Mariam.
Very much, and thank you for mentioning all those points, because it's so important to get it out there. Caesarean section has changed. Having a child, being pregnant, has changed so much over the years. It is interesting. Over the last 28 years that I've been practicing, we have become really very open about the way we counsel our patients in pregnancy and their choices of birth. Women become pregnant, even before they become pregnant, their pre-pregnancy counseling is undertaken. When they become pregnant, they are assessed at every point. There are several points in the pregnancy that we look at as milestones that women cross through. So first trimester, you're looking at anomaly and anatomy and just making sure that baby's okay. Here at Gagash, we do a lot of scanning in the fetal maternal medicine clinic. When you go on into your second trimester, we're looking for diabetes, we're looking for growth issues, we're looking for the way the baby's presenting. Is the baby correctly positioned for labor? And then towards the end, it's all about delivery planning. And I can't stress delivery planning more because, you know, like you mentioned, women, one, should have choice, and two, even where the choices that they have to, the choices they have to make are slightly out of their own control, they need to be supported through, you know, the type of delivery that they're having. Mm. It is true that if a woman has a completely uncomplicated so-called low-risk pregnancy, I don't really like that term because low-risk can very easily become high-risk. But assuming there is no concern in that pregnancy, then the woman should be supported to have a natural birth. But she has to also be aware that even during natural birth, lots of things can go wrong. And women may end up having to have an emergency caesarean section, having labored for hours. By far, that's nothing to be ashamed of at all. In fact, I call them heroes. You know, I often tell my patients, we don't give out badges for how much pain and how much discomfort you've experienced in labor. But these women are heroes where they have to go through labor and for reasons beyond their own control have to end up having an emergency caesarean section, either because of fetal distress or the labor did not progress or a combination of both. You know, these women should be supported.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those wanting to have elective caesareans should also be supported depending on what the indication is. Because it's not easy. It's not an easy procedure to have. You know, it's swapping, I would say, you know, because Yes, a labor, during the labor, a natural delivery, it's painful. You've got your pain relief. You know, you're going through all of it at the time. And with a planned elective cesarean section, it's relatively pain-free. But afterwards, there is a lot to cope with.
Yeah, of course. Dr. Marion, just very quickly, because I'm conscious of time, just 20 seconds. Question come through from one of our listeners. What if there's a strong maternal history of urinary incontinence? Will it be an indication for a C-section?
It's a very good question. Now, urinary incontinence, i.e. genuine stress incontinence, I presume our listener is talking about, you have to find out why. I've just alluded to the fact that there are many causes for urinary incontinence. But assuming that it is related to a weakness in the bladder neck or a malpositioning in the bladder neck, we know that this is not because the woman pushed or because she was in labor for a very long time. We know that bladder neck dysfunction can actually happen as soon as the woman is pregnant, actually, as soon as she's crossed into the second and third part of the pregnancy, so from 14 weeks onwards. So pushing per se does not cause or does not aggravate bladder neck dysfunction, which causes urinary incontinence. And so, again, this is a careful decision between the clinician and the patient regarding what she's going to do to try to prevent worsening symptoms of urinary incontinence after her baby, what she can do before she goes into labor, et cetera, to reduce the chance of worsening incontinence. There is a lot. It's a whole topic on its own. But suffice to say, it's not an indication to have a cesarean section.
Okay. Thanks so much for clearing that up. And thank you very much, Dr. Mariam, for joining us on the line today. Just to raise awareness, it is Cesarean Awareness Month. And great to answer those questions for us today. All the very best to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Siobhan.
Dr. Mariam Georgette Awatai, who's the OB-GYN at Gargash Hospital.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon. I'm Siobhan Leydon. I'm sitting in for Helen today. And coming up on our education focus this hour, I'll be discussing leadership in children. What does it mean and how can leadership skills be taught and why? I'm joined now by Hanan Ezzedine, an experienced and certified positive discipline educator for both parents and teachers. She's a parent herself and she's been teaching and educating for over 11 years in four different countries. Hanan is also the founder of the hugely popular online platform, The Family Hub, which is designed to educate, support and inspire parents to raise well-balanced children who are a positive addition to society. Hanan, great to have you on the line with us today. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start, first of all, with talking a little bit about the Family Hub. What happens on this platform and why did you decide to launch it?
Actually, it's one of my new babies, if you like. And I love, you know, sharing all the information that I've gained, you know, moving with the family across all of these countries, teaching all of those kids. I've taught over 2,000 kids in the last few years. And it's just amazing, you know, when you learn all about, you know, positive discipline and how much it can really affect the whole family in a very positive, very enlightening way. So we're just sharing a lot of content, doing workshops, sessions, and so on to support families in raising balanced children. So, yeah, I love being a part of it.
And it's an online platform, so I'm presuming there's lots of communication, there's lots of interactions, or things like that.
There's a lot of engagement, and I'm happy that a lot of parents are, you know, finding new ways to really explore all the benefits that kind of come out of, you know, teaching their children in a different way. Mm. And I love it. I love being a part of that.
It's interesting. We're talking about leadership. We're also talking about positive discipline. And I suppose stereotypically, discipline is oftentimes being associated with something negative. You know, don't do this, don't do that, you shouldn't be that. Whereas you're actually flipping that on its head and saying it could be actually more positive discipline. Can you explain that terminology?
Of course. A lot of parents are, you know, sometimes they think, oh, we want everybody to be happy. So we're going to be, you know, everything will be a yes and everything will be OK. But what happens there, that kids can turn out to be a little bit spoiled, a little bit, you know, materialistic and so on. And on the other side, they think, OK, we have to be very strict and we have to be very, you know, a lot of negative discipline comes in saying no, no, no all the time. So what we're trying to do is saying, OK, we have to set boundaries. We have to set, you know, guidelines. But we also need to be kind and firm. And it's just making that balance through a lot of trial and error and through a lot of, you know, scientific exploration of a lot of psychological principles by the best psychologists in the world. you can really come out with very simple strategies on a daily basis that can help your kids be the best versions of themselves. And this is what we're trying to bring light on, shed light on.
It would be great if you might be able to just shed some light on those today for myself, actually, included, and our listeners. Maybe just talk us through a couple of examples, if you may.
Of course, like, for example, when you have, you know, your kids, they want something from the supermarket and then they throw tantrums and so on. And how do you develop that? Instead of, you know, a lot of people will just ignore their kids, or they're going to give in to their request just to get them to be silent, you know, and not create that scene in the supermarket. But it's how do you actually teach your kids, you know, when do you ask for something? When do you, how do we react to that? How do we calm them down? How do we give them choices? How do we make them strong enough so that they can make their own choices on their own, and so on and so forth? And it's really, it's interesting how you see that, because I do that with my own family. My kids are teenagers now. And when I look at this, I know that, you know, it's tried and tested. I've seen it happen so many times. There's a lot of validation involved, a lot of validation to their feelings, but also you get to say no when you should say no. Kids will respect it, and they'll know. I mean, kids thrive under boundaries, and that's a principle that was foreign to me before I started to learn this, you know, in my master's degrees and so on, that kids thrive under boundaries. They thrive under structure, but they also need that warmth from us, you know, that warmth, that hug, that validation that their feelings matter, and that's when they start to react progressively.
So it's all about creating the fine balance, isn't it, between saying no too much but also having boundaries, and exactly. not being afraid to say no, actually, because of the potential consequences.
Exactly. How to say no.
How do you say no? Do you just say no? It's not happening.
Yeah, sometimes you just say no. Sometimes you just say no. But a lot of times, like, after you have the same fight like 20 times with the kids, you kind of know that it's coming. Like, if every time there's a bedtime and they're going to try to prolong that period and say, okay, no, I want five more minutes, and that 5 minutes turns into 30, you know that there's a problem when it comes to bedtime. So you know that this is when you have to step in with the routines. You can step in with a routine chart that they put together and that you are consistently following up on until the bedtime is no longer an issue. And it's not a hit and miss. So it's not like, and it's not applicable to every single situation. But sometimes when you put down those guidelines very simply with your kids, they will start to proactively react. And that's what we're looking for. I mean, mine right now, when it's time for their work, they will put up their own, you know, schedules, they'll put up their own charts, and they will mess up every once in a while, and we have to step in again, and we have to support again, and so on. But the concept is there that we are, you know, more organized, that we take initiative, and so on and so forth. And it really does reduce the struggles. Like, when I do workshops, especially around the whole bedtime routines thing, parents after, and I say it takes 2 to 4 weeks to put down strategies and habits and so on. After that, the parents come out, you know, they're happy, they're sleeping, they're not struggling on a daily basis with screen time, with things like that. So you kind of preempt the situation.
I think it's interesting that you said that it takes 2 to 4 weeks. This is not an overnight thing, you know. It takes a long time. You have to put the work in. If you put the work in, then, of course, hopefully at the end of it, it will come out. Now, the platitude is, I suppose, is true, is as a parent, you are the most important teacher for your child, aren't you? So whatever you
do,
your kids will follow, your kids will mimic, they will copy, they will look to you as being their role leaders. So, you know, unless you are putting those boundaries in and are being the one who's going to be the disciplinarian, then where else are they going to really get it from?
No, I agree. And honestly, as a teacher in class, parents are a lot of times surprised. You know, in parent-teacher conferences, they're surprised when I say, you know, their kids follow instructions, they're doing their work, they're doing this. And they're like, but they don't listen to us at home. And the idea is, it's not because we're amazing teachers in school. It's because there are, you know, there's a structure. And when there's a structure, the kids will follow. And sometimes they won't, which is okay. And there are, you know, regressions. But at the end of the day, you have this framework that you can fall back on, you know?
Yeah.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon. We're talking with Hanan Ezzedine, who is an experienced and certified positive discipline educator. She's also the founder of the hugely popular online platform, The Family Hub. If you'd like to check it out, you can do so, of course, at thefamilyhub_Hanan. Get involved. Lots of positive feedback on there as well. We were talking to Hanan about positive discipline and the importance of it, really, to build disciplined children. And positive being the operative word there, not necessarily always about the negative, but about creating boundaries for your children, which are extremely important. Moving on a little bit, Hanan, I'd like to talk a little bit now about leadership and how do you create a leader? How can you teach your children to be leaders?
That's a wonderful question. And actually, a lot of times we see the leaders as those kids who are, you know, captain of the football team, you know, the class president, those kids who are, you know, outspoken, extroverts and so on, and who are doing a wonderful job. But there are also those silent leaders, the kids who, in my opinion, are the ones who take initiative. And those are like the silent heroes. You know, the kids, Jovan, who, you know, if there's a lonely kid in the cafeteria, they're the ones who are going to go sit with them. Mm-hmm. If there's someone who's struggling a little bit in school, they're the ones who are going to sit with them and make sure that they are up to date and they're reading and writing and so on in the same way. They're also the kids who will share without expecting, you know, waiting for a gratitude or thank you or so on. They invite everybody to birthday parties because they don't want anyone to be left alone and so on. The ones who are not just bystanders, but who stand up to their friends if there's a bullying issue or someone who's being mean and so on. And for me, as a parent and as a teacher, and I see this every day, these are the kids who are, you know, the real leaders. Because at the end of the day, the concept of leadership is the one, the kid who takes initiative. Mm. And usually those little things, they go by, you know, unrewarded. And I'm glad that, you know, as we've seen schools progress and see schools move forward, there's a highlight now on integrity, on ethics, on things other than the academic and sports achievements.
Yeah.
And those little things are now highlighted. And all of us as teachers, we're getting trained on and on and on to notice those fine things, you know, these little things behind the scenes. And make sure that we give them a lot of positive encouragement so that we can see more of that behavior in classrooms as well as at home.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, Hanan. And it's wonderful to see that. And I see with my own children things like this coming through. They have Star of the Week and they have the MAD Award, which is something really interesting, yeah. Learning different skills. And it's not just who got 100%, who got 80% and who scored the most goals or this or the other. You know, it's highlighting and just looking at, as you said, these other qualities that are in children, which are equally as important, I think, developing an all-round child. And it's wonderful that all these things are being highlighted in school, but how can you then continue that work that's been done in school and sort of reiterate that sort of work at home? And how can parents, you know, again, continue to highlight and congratulate their children on the other skills that they are doing or that they have?
I think one of the most important things is that we need to stop comparing, as a general rule, comparing kids to what we expect them to be, because they're not always going to turn out, you know, at the best based on our own expectations. So we have to understand that maybe if I'm a doctor, my son could be artistic and could be an amazing artist. And we have to understand that those kids come in with a different set of skills, and they're going to be leaders in that field that's different from what I want or what I'm expecting. Mm. And that's a big issue that we see right now, you know, where you see kids being forced into doing things that they're not really shining at or enjoying because their parents think that this is the way to go. So it's important for us to get our kids to try a lot of things, but also understand when it's just not working. And a lot of things, another way of comparison as well is that sometimes we put kids into boxes. So, for example, you could have a kid who is, you could have a child who's like a brilliant sports kid, you know, he's doing very well at sports, but then he has a sibling who isn't so much. So you would label that first child as, you know, the athlete in the family and not give a lot of attention when it comes to anything that has to do with sports for the other one. And we tend to create those comparisons between siblings and cousins and friends and so on, yeah. And put the kids into labels. The idea is that when we start putting those kids into invisible boxes, they will never achieve what they can achieve. Like, they're never going to be able to achieve their full potential because of they think in their head that they're not good enough because of the way that we're labeling them. Mm. So we need to stop as much as we can, stop ourselves from doing that and wait and give kids a chance until they bloom. I have a friend of mine who has a child who she did not think was athletic at all until he was 14. Today, they're Canadian, and today in Canada, he is on the Olympic athletic team as the number one sprinter.
A late bloomer.
I know, and it took, exactly, and it took 14 years. But the thing is that it happens, and maybe they're not all going to be, you know, Olympic athletes, but at least they could rise to the potential if they feel that we are, you know, backing them up in whatever it is that they want. And those comparisons are really important. And the way that we label and the way that we address the kids is really, really important.
Hanan, thank you so much for talking to us today. Some really positive words from you. And I think, and do check out your Instagram handle as if you'd like to learn more. It's at @thefamilyhub_Hanan. Hanan Ezzedine, thank you so much. All the very best to you. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Shivan. Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be part of the Dubai Eye family. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was Hanan Ezzedine. She's the founder of The Family Hub, a platform that teaches parents all about positive parenting. Great advice on how parents can encourage children to become leaders. We
are family. Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon. I'm Siobhan Layden. I'm sitting in for Helen Farmer today and tomorrow. And up next, it's our education focus. And let me ask you, can every child be a leader? Well, according to the founding principal of the Royal Guildford School, Dubai, this is possible, as a recent article entitled Every Child Can Be a Leader. So what does being a leader actually mean? How do you teach leadership? And most importantly, why should we want our children to be leaders? I'm joined now by Mr. Craig Lamshed, who is the founding principal of Royal Guildford School, Dubai. Craig, great to have you with us today. And that, just to give you a little bit of context before we do start, RGS, or Royal Guildford School, was established in 1509. So it's got quite a bit of history behind it and experience. And it's one of the most academically successful all-boys schools in the UK. So RGS Dubai is going to open its doors to boys and girls in September of this year. Craig, great to have you on the line with us today. Thank you so much. Now, you bring over 25 years experience of education and senior leadership to the UAE. Now, you must be all in it right now, in the midst of it, because I understand that I've actually seen pictures online of the construction as well. How's it all going? How is it all on track to be open and ready in September of this year?
First of all, look, thank you very much for inviting me on this afternoon. I'm absolutely delighted to be here speaking to you today and talking about our Riata program and the leadership within RGS. Look, in terms of the school, absolutely, we're 100% on track. RGS Guildford Dubai will be up and running come September. I mean, the building, as you mentioned, is coming along incredibly well. We hope that to open ahead of schedule, which is really nice for this, for the region. Can't wait to get the students in there. Can't wait to start to develop the curriculum with the young people and to really have a rich program for them come September.
Can I just ask you, is it just going to be sort of a copy-paste of what happens in the UK, or will the school in Dubai have its own personality of sorts in what you're teaching? Is it going to be very different, and how do you have these affiliations? Like, what does it mean if you go to the school here? Will it be completely recognised globally as being, you know, the Royal Guildford School, and carry with it that weight and that gravitas of what the school is in the UK?
It's not going to be a cookie cut. It's not going to be exactly the same. I mean, the curriculum needs to be bespoke to the UAE. It needs to be bespoke to Dubai to ensure the very best success, but we'll take all the best parts of RGS Guildford and we'll add on to those to make a very rich experience for our young people in Dubai.
Fantastic. So let's move on now, and in particular to one of the RGS leadership programmes, which you mentioned briefly, Riada, which actually means leadership in Arabic. Now, I understand that there are six pillars or learning principles to this. You've got organisation, engagement, imagination, perseverance, aspiration and reflection. How will these pillars be woven into the curriculum, Craig?
In the early years, I mean, we will use those values to talk to young people about how they manage themselves, what it looks like to be a leader, what it looks like to manage themselves in terms of do they know themselves, how they manage themselves in terms of their relationships with their peers and with other people. I think as we grow further up to the school, then we'll look at the broader aspects of within the larger context of students and leadership across a larger border in terms of with across the class, across within the school. And obviously, when we go further down the line, we'll look at using those values to try and get a larger influence in terms of students and their impact across a global society, whether that's within Dubai or within the region. I think the important thing is, in terms of those values, is that it's not just about intrinsically teaching them, but it's about using them every day. We'll be looking for students to experience those within the classroom, but we'll also be looking for students to experience those outside of the classroom.
So, Craig, what do you mean by a leader, first of all? How would you define a leader? What does it mean to be a leader?
When we talk about leadership, people all generally put that to, are you the head boy, head girl? Are you the head of the sports team? Are you the head of the debating team? To me, it's a set of values and a set of underpinnings, a set of beliefs, a set of skill sets and attributes that actually make you work better with other people. It's about, you know, knowing yourself. I mean, being really, really quite intrinsic in terms of, do I understand myself, my strengths, my areas of development? It's about relationships with others. So how am I working with other people? How do I maximize that relationship for the broader good, making the world a better place? It's not a position. It's a set of understandings, a set of beliefs, a set of reflections. And I think our, you know, if you go back to what we said before in terms of our values, like integrity, respect, courage, collaboration, inclusivity, you know, they're all very strong attributes that one would want in a leader for their young children.
You mentioned earlier also, and as Guildford School is very much renowned for, is its academic prowess. Now, many would say that, yeah, it's great to have academic results and it's great that they get the A stars, etc., in all the various different subjects. But to be a leader and to be an all-rounded human being, you need more than that. It's not just about the grades. Is this sort of part and parcel of that whole leadership programme that you are recognising that it's not just about, as we said, getting the grades and the A's, but it's also just it's instilling more different types of skills in your students for life skills, let's say?
I think academic aspiration is 100%. I mean, it's a focus of the RGS, and we will definitely have that in place. We'll challenge students to be better every day in terms of, you know, where they are today in terms of their academics and how we can help them move forward. So I think it's really important that when the students leave the school, that we've developed themselves. You know, we are very much about, you know, we talk about developing, you know, a wonderful child, a whole, you know, character development, a whole being, or really focus on the individual child. So I think, obviously, we all know that when you move out into the broader world, it's about how well you can work with other people. It's about looking for opportunities to have impact, about making sure that, you know, yourself, you know what you need to do to move forward, to work with other people. So I think it is more about just the academic. I mean, and obviously, we'll be looking to try and broaden it throughout a curriculum. As I said before, you know, it brings together the moral education curriculum, the PSHE curriculum, and we've obviously entwined that into the actual curriculum within the school, as well as enhancing our actual RIATA leadership strand. So we hope to be able to offer a really broad, engaging curriculum that will help our young people recognise their attributes, you know, which ones, and help them, I suppose, look for opportunities to develop them further, so that when they do actually leave the school, they are this fully rounded, wonderful, young, resilient, confident person that we want them to be.
Now, you wrote an article recently called Every Child Can Be a Leader. Now, this may be true, but not every child wants to be a leader. What about those reluctant ones that are just, you know, I suppose, I know we're talking about leadership in different ways, as you have already mentioned. It's not just, you know, leading a crowd or being the one in charge, or, you know, it's a whole culmination of different skills. But there are many that, you know, won't be the head of the hockey team. They won't be the head boy and these things, but they will have skills or leadership skills or empathy skills, and we'll show them in different ways. How important is it to recognise that as well as those that are going to be the A-stars?
Look, it's very interesting. If I reflect back on when I was a child, I remember that everyone, you know, it was like, well, you're a leader. Well, you have a titled post. You know, you're this person. It was only one person or 10 people. And again, I don't think it's about that. It's really about our young people having a set of values and a set of understandings. And I think all students, all pupils, no matter what their aspirations are, you know, we can develop that in everyone. So it's about saying to a young person, here's an opportunity for you to self-reflect, to work with others, to work in a team. Maybe it's to lead the team today. Maybe it's to work in a team tomorrow, to help them actually look for that, as I said before, that sort of greater good, to have impact. So we will work with those young people, albeit the ones that want to lead from the front, absolutely. Maybe the ones that want to lead from behind, yeah, 100%. And some of those students who for the first instance, may not be interested, but we'll work with them to develop those skills and those abilities as we go along.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Good afternoon. Let's continue now our conversation with Craig Lamshed. He's the founding principal of Royal Guildford School Dubai, soon to open its doors in September. So it's very exciting. Construction is underway. Craig also just mentioned earlier it's going to be definitely on time. In fact, ahead of time. It has got such a wonderful history, has the Royal Guildford School, which started its life back in the UK in London in 1509. Craig brings 25 years experience of education and senior leadership experience to the UAE. So it's great to have him joining us on the line today. Now, many, Craig, are at this time, I suppose, again, due to the pandemic, things have been completely thrown in the air with homeschooling and more online learning. And it's just, I suppose, thrown into question, really, the whole education system itself. Many are calling for a huge overhaul of the education, in part driven by the pandemic, homeschooling, but also, I think, as the world, as we know, it is changing so rapidly, like the jobs of today are not necessarily going to be the jobs of the future. Universities are being criticised for offering courses, you know, just for the sake of it, for 4 years learning something and you come out of it with nothing apart from a big debt. And I think there's a real push towards more practical, skill-based learnings, you know, working with companies, doing internships, rather than coming out with education, but with, you know, not being able to actually do anything in terms of how a job is concerned. What are some of your thoughts on that? Are you... You know, as I said, the school has been around since the 1500s. I know, of course, it has changed since then. But do you feel that, as an educationist yourself, that the system is still open enough to change and to, you know, looking at what kids now need for a world which is so different to my generation, to my parents' generation?
Look, the first thing I'd like to say is, I mean, 500 years RGS Guildford in terms of innovation and refinement in terms of what makes young people very successful, both academically and as people. And I think one of the main things is when you talk to the RGS team is that real sense of development of the character of young people, which supports them in terms of academic outcomes as well. So I think I 100% agree in terms of, is it just about academic pathways anymore? No, it's not. It's about offering children a breadth of pathways, and that's something we'll be very cognizant of when we open our, you know, secondary school provision going into GCSE and post-16s. We'll be looking at the individual learner and what pathway can we offer them to make them the very most successful. I think that's very true for what that's what we're saying in terms of now. We're very much about the independent child. How can we take one pupil, move them from day one to day two and add value to them? Mm. But again, it comes back to our learning habits and our value set. I think they're fundamental to add significant value to the academic provision that the school has also. The other part of your question, though, was in terms of vocational pathways. I think 100% that there's definitely a place for vocational pathways, and that's something we'll be looking at developing. And we've obviously got a couple of other pretty exciting things in the pipeline at the moment, so hopefully parents and the community will be very happy about that once the time comes to announce those.
Mm. I think vocational skills are absolutely paramount, aren't they, to learning those life skills that you can put to use when you do leave the academic institutions. Just a few quick fire round, though, for you, Craig. So are admissions open?
Admissions 100% are open. We're taking admissions from FS through to Year 6.
Right.
And we're very pleased to say the level of interest in the school has been really positive. So again, Claire Turnbull, the head of prep, has been very busy, you know, speaking to parents. So if parents want to come down to Tulalo Gaff and meet us, we'd love to have a conversation with them and see how we can support their young people in their future career and future education. And as I said before, the building is 100% on track and ahead of track. So we hope to be able to have people on site, hopefully early June, touch wood. So, you know, we look forward to having people actually come to the school.
Fantastic.
And have a look around.
Well, exciting news, and great to have you on the line to tell us a little bit about the school. I wish you all the very, very best with everything, and good luck for September.
Thank you very much for having me on today.
Pleasure. Thank you. Craig Lamshed there, founding principal of the Royal Guildford School, Dubai, set to open its doors in September for boys and girls of this year.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Join the conversation
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You can listen to all the podcasts on our website, dubaieye103.com, or indeed wherever you get your podcasts. And do tune in live to Afternoons with Helen Farmer, weekdays from 2 till 5.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.